Jaguar, everybody.
Jaguar.
Hello and welcome to our next episode. This is like the third part of chapter 2 of the autobiography of a yogi. And as you know, we're going through it line by line. And I'm joined today again by Lauren and Chris. How are you guys doing?
Hi, guys. Very good. Thank you. Yeah. Happy to be here. We had a nice discussion before we joined this call, and we were saying that we always struggle not to just start delving into the details of, you know, what we want to discuss now. So we have to have discipline not to cover the ground that we want to spontaneously talk about during the call. So we've restrained ourselves. We're ready to go. And looking forward to the episode.
Yeah. We also haven't met in about 2 weeks. So I feel like we've got all that excited energy, you know. I actually really missed it, not having one last week. I was like, oh, I want to come back. So it's really nice to be here.
Same. I'm actually never sure what the right balance is, what to record, because every time we have a conversation going on and we say something that is like interesting, and I feel like, oh, we should have recorded that. So. But then also a lot of it is just small talk and catching up. So I guess there is a balance to strike, a happy middle, happy medium.
Yeah.
So in this part, we will go through. So we have Yogananda's mother has passed away, but she has left something for Yogananda that she gave it to Yogananda's oldest brother, Ananta, to give it to Yogananda 1 year after her passing. And it's a little note, and it's an amulet. And that has significance. And she, in that note, she talks about that she actually had a premonition, or she it was presaged his birth by Lahiri Mahashaya. And it was talked about that he would have a mission in this world to spread the message of Lahiri Mahashaya, and he would be what he calls a spiritual engine, which is a great word, and his ambitions would not be worldly, his ambitions would be spiritual, which is interesting, and I guess that's what we can start with. So I guess when Ananta heard that, he was not, I guess he did not agree, or he did not find it very important. He did not feel like devoting your life to spirituality is worthwhile. And he was actually giving Mukunda that message late. He was supposed to give it to him 1 year later, but here we are 14 months on, and we had Mukunda just trying to escape to the Himalayas. And that might have been one of the reasons why Ananta finally gave the message to him, because he felt, even if I don't give him that message, he is, this is like his inner calling. Chris?
It's quite amazing, this section. Because the mystical in life is maybe beyond the reach of most of us. And if you're lucky, you have these moments where you have these mystical experiences. But here we're talking about something that's, for many, beyond belief. You know, for many, it's part of a more of an understanding of how the world works. And here's somebody who's clearly quite excelled in Yogananda's mother receiving a message from Lahiri Mahashaya. And the backstory is that, maybe you want to go into this, Mike, but that she was praying and Lahiri Mahashaya comes and gives her an answer to say, hey, you know, essentially, yes, your son is going to be a special soul. You know, it's going to bring more souls back to God, going to be the spiritual engine. And that moment, it's so beautiful, because the mother, her heart leapt for joy, and it's such a lovely recognition of that divine touch and presence in her life. But she holds this to her own, you know, close to her chest. We don't know. Maybe she shares it with Bhagavati, with her husband, with Yogananda's father, or not. Like, we don't seem to have this information, I don't think, unless that is tucked away somewhere. That would be interesting to find out. But she holds this information, like this mystical, marvelous, divine information, so close to her chest. And she tells her son, and he holds it close to his chest. And they don't talk about it, you know. And we, like you said, Mike, the question is maybe why, or what the motivations were. But I think it's just such restraint and such faith, I would say, in God's plan, in letting things unfold in time. But for me, you know, if somebody told me about a sibling, or, you know, somebody was going to be a spiritual engine and this message came from God, you would let it slip, you know, from a brother to brother, would you not? I mean, you would let it slip, I think. So it's amazing restraint from all sides. I think it's pretty incredible.
Especially for the mum, because she was extremely spiritual, wasn't she? She was so in tune. So for her to have been delivered an instruction to say, well, you have to wait a year, you have to give it to this person, like, she followed that down to the T, and she made sure that that happened. But his brother, however, is another story, isn't it? And well, I don't want to go too far on, but as I'm speaking of it now, you know, he says how he was reluctant, wasn't he, to give that to him. But to jump slightly ahead, the person that made this happen, you know, said that little Mukunda should receive it about the time he is ready to renounce all worldly hopes and to start his vital search for God. And perhaps in some strange way, I'm going to use that word, maybe it was delivered at the exact time. And perhaps its delay was in accordance with the law. That's something we may never know intellectually, but we can prophesize nonetheless. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, Priyank raised the question, you know, the mother passed this message on. I mean, I'm jumping ahead. Maybe Mike, jump in if you want to
go for
you
it.
Want to control the pace of this.
We just need to do a quick shout out to Priya, because for people who follow us on social media, they probably can see that he's on an epic journey in India right now and shooting amazing short videos. And he can't be with us, but he still looked at what we're talking about today, and he put in some of the talking points. So yeah, go for it.
Nice. Yes, hi to Priyank. He may be well listening to this in time. And the question maybe is, why did the mother wait until her deathbed? And it is quite a sudden death as well. We know that she was healthy one day, the next day she was gone. But she still managed to get this message out on her deathbed. But why did she wait? You know, it's a world with many possibilities, many things can happen. You know, she was struck with this awful illness, so it's a risk really of waiting, isn't it, with this delicate, beautiful message. So I don't know, I don't have the answer to that. It is a curious question, why she did wait. But you know, timing, divine timing is something that, as we're going to talk about it later in the episode, about baptism and maybe following the voice that is God, that can come through baptism. Maybe she was following this voice. Maybe she was really going with the inner voice that was telling her, it's not the right time. It's not the right time. And maybe actually I can share a story about this, because I was going through a meditation, intense meditation session years ago. And I remember at nighttime, the thought of meeting somebody, you know, a partner, was on my mind. And I was actually praying. I was like, okay, I think I'm ready to meet somebody. I think, you know, I'm ready to meet somebody that I can share a life with, and be a true partner with. And I kept getting this message like, no, you're not ready. No, you're not ready. And I thought, oh, this is just fanciful. This is just my imagination or something. But I still got the message, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't jump into it. I'll just put it to one side. It'll come. And But I got the message that I still needed to work on myself before I could go out into the world and find this partner of mine. And it truly kind of unfolded that way, which was quite a nice thing for me. So maybe this is something that the mother's certainly capable of, having received this amazing blessing from Yogananda's guru's guru in Lahiri Mahesha. And she was listening to this inner voice and being guided by the Holy Spirit, in a sense.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with divine timing. And I really like the story you just shared with us, Chris, because that kind of is often how life is, where if we follow our intuition, we don't really understand why things can't happen now, because our mind has that idea that we need something to happen now, not later, right? And but you also don't know why sometimes the time isn't right. You're not ready, like you said, Chris. Maybe Guruji needed to get this message at exactly the right time. And maybe it was also other people involved, like Ananta, right? Maybe it made a difference in his life. And another thing is that Guruji's mother, she followed, we're going to go into this in the next episode, but of course, the event, how she got the amulet, was miraculous. And she was all, it came with instructions, which she followed, which she didn't forgo.
But one thing just to add here, we know with the beautiful ability of hindsight that, yes, Yogananda's mother gave the message on her deathbed. She would have known that she was probably going to die. But she mightn't have known the significance of what was going to unfold thereafter, which Yogananda went through a very painful period, didn't he? A very, you know, heartbreaking period where he was, you know, demanding that God give him answers, and he got those answers. And he was using that raw emotion, that pain that he felt, to amplify this, you know, this calling to God. So maybe, you know, as we know, looking in hindsight, all these things that happen in your life, you know, looking back, it maybe happened for a reason. You know, looking back, they actually play to your strengths and make you stronger. So maybe that's another thing that just had to happen to unlock this spiritual engine inside of Yogananda, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Totally. If we go back to what you said in the beginning, Chris, where you said her mother was very spiritual, and because of that, she naturally, as it is Hindu custom, went to her guru to have her son blessed by him. Do you think she was actually praying for him to be spiritual? Like, that's kind of what mothers often do, right? They hope their children follow their path. And do you think she got more than she expected when Lahiri Mahesha not only blessed Mukunda, but he said, little mother, thy son will be a yogi, which might have been a lot more than she expected to get back from that?
I mean, if I was to be pedantic, I would say, well, what do you mean by expected? Because she was clearly advanced. So maybe your ego might expect one thing, but this intuition, this inner voice isn't surprised. And maybe that's what I was kind of alluding to when she said, my heart leapt with joy to find my secret prayer granted. You know, she didn't say, oh, and then I fell off my seat because, you know, I was surprised. You know, she was truly happy. She was, you know, it was a very affirming moment for her, I suppose, from what we can interpret in this text. She said, shortly before your birth, he had told me that you would follow his path. So she went from, you know, being initiated into Kriya and, you know, meeting Lahiri Mahesha, I think, for the first time on that day, to receiving this message. So she took it all in her stride. So I don't think it was, you know, beyond surprise for somebody like her, who was clearly quite spiritually advanced.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, and I think so too. Another thing, you touched on it earlier, was that the fact that Ananta was passing on the amulet to Mukunda. So she made him part of this transaction. And then to give some context, from what I read in Mechta and in the Autobiography of a Yogi, I feel like Ananta is like the classic older brother. And in Indian families, the oldest brother has a strong role, right? He's like almost like a third parent. And he wants to see his siblings grow up to be successful, to focus on the things that he focuses on, to focus on academic success, on success professionally. And I'm not sure how important spirituality is for him, but it's definitely not number one. And that's the context you have to see. Yes, Lauren?
I feel like perhaps Ananta is like a reflection of that inner cynic, may not be the right word, but I'll use it for now, like the inner cynic within us. Because, you know, he says that he didn't want to, he'd had this experience with his mother. He knew that he had to deliver this, but he didn't want to. And he held off for a long time because, you know, he didn't, you know, perhaps see that as an important thing. But when he saw how, you know, Mukunda had that divine spirit flowing through him, and he had such ardor for God that actually he couldn't hold off any longer. And perhaps that's also a reflection of kind of what happens for us. You know, we live in this life and it gets to a point where the messages are so strong that you can't ignore it anymore. And it's kind of a mirror of that in a way, which is actually a nice little reminder and a message.
I completely agree. And I feel like becoming spiritual from, I would say, from a normal material life, transitioning into it, you go through stages, right? You go, and in the beginning, definitely you find out about this possibility of meditating, and you find this is a good routine. This helps me do my work better. This helps me be more calm. And you try to rationalize it in this way, right? That this is kind of something that helps me do everything else better. But then after a while, it takes over bigger parts of your life, right? And it's until it becomes a supreme goal in your life at some point. And some people even, they then join a monastic order or just focus on it 100%. And I feel like everyone goes through those transitions. And that's, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Yeah, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting with the family's attitude towards spirituality versus materialism. And we know India today is still a developing country, and in many parts still, you know, there's still a lot of poverty. So having material wealth is important for, you know, in many modern aspects. And 100 years ago, maybe that was even stronger in some ways, you know, really the push to try to become more spiritually more materially wealthy in some ways. So I'm not surprised to hear, you know, somebody with great intellect in Bhagavati saying things like focus on your career. You know, if you want to get ahead, famously saying to his employee, you know, focus on your career, which ended up landing him in the lap of Lahiri Masha, of course. But the attitude of the family seems to, you know, certainly be not focused on materialism, but it's on their mind. But I think looking at pictures of what we know about the sisters, you know, spirituality is still very strong within the family, and that's an understatement because of what we know as the mother and father being very spiritually inclined and being initiated into Kriya and everything. So it's curious to me, by, you know, no means that I think that it's a small thing to say that somebody is going to be a spiritual engine and follow the spiritual path and, you know, be a dev or a monk, for example, and devote their life to God. The family, knowing that, held off as much as possible to try to give Yogananda a firm grounding in maybe education and things that might still be important to Yogananda. And we know later on it very much was important to him because he went to the United States and he ran an incredibly successful organization. And he was extremely involved in these things. Not that he needed necessarily a good education in India to do that, but he certainly did put that to use.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Chris. And later on, Sri Yukteswar tells Guruji that he even has to, like, he's done with high school and he goes like, I'm done with education. And then Sri Yukteswar tells him, no, you should also go to college and finish it because I'll send you to the US and in the US people will receive you. They will listen to you more if you have an academic title. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that is from the beginning to the end. Like, it's interesting you mentioned Bhagavati, because I feel a lot of the traits that Ananta has, he probably got from his father. His father, who we learned in earlier episodes, had a difficult upbringing, right? His father passed away early in life, and he had to basically be the dad of the family as being the eldest son. And having a very humble childhood, but then working really hard, getting a great career, taking care of his mother and his siblings, and then also starting his own family. And I guess this is kind of of course, has to be rubbing off on his children, and definitely on Ananta, and we have to say also on Mukunda, right? Because he is driven on a spiritual mission, but also he always attracts those people who are very successful in a material sense in India and also in the United States. If we think of Rajasi, or if we think of the Maharaja of Kasim Bazar, who funds his school that he has in Ranchi later on. I have to stop putting out so many spoilers because.
Spoiler alert, just follows you around.
Yes, let's stay with what we got. Let's go through this one more time. Let's go through this one more time with Ananta. Do you guys feel that by making Ananta part of this transaction, it was kind of a way to push Ananta show him the importance of spirituality, maybe in his own life, or at least prove to him how important Guruji's spiritual mission is for him, and that he shouldn't really be trying to sabotage him? Because I feel like that's what he's really doing, right? He's really trying to not have Guruji or Mukunda unfold as this spiritual personality. He basically wants him to forget about this and instead be good at school and have a good career. I feel like this is the main thing. And one cue we also get is that he's even delaying giving him the prophecy, probably feeling like he doesn't even want to give it to him at all. Yes, Chris?
Yeah, maybe for sure that could be correct. I was thinking that when she gave this message to Ananta, it was on her deathbed, it was during the wedding preparations. So everybody apart from Mukunda and Mukunda's father were there from the family. And Ananta is the eldest in the family, right? So that's probably why, through this more hierarchical structure, did he receive the message. And I suppose if you were him, the fear of messing up, to say to young Mukunda too early that, hey, by the way, Mom had this amazing message for you, you're going to be the spiritual engine, you know, do these things, and by the way, here's an amulet. Like, that's such a responsibility, isn't it? And, you know, the mother's not there. That would have been more and more of a responsibility on his shoulders. that message. So you did an amazing job to kind of hold on to that, let's say, for when maybe we look back in hindsight, Bakunda would have been ready. Maybe it was enough time after his mother's passing for the wounds to heal, for him to be, you know, mature, more mature to be able to deal with that. And he was very, very young. So we can't look at this with, you know, one, you know, lens where we think of Yogananda as this infinite deathless guru. You know, he would have been more young at the time and less able to handle a message like that so early on. Probably did very well to hold on to that.
Yeah, I feel like there's a definite truth in there, Chris. Like, it feels like it was divine timing. And I think also we have to remember that it's not really Ananta, it's just God moving through him. So even though, you know, he may be displaying these qualities of being, you know, not spiritual or holding back, it's actually all for the divine purpose. Like, that amulet came to Mukunda and that message came to Mukunda exactly when it needed to, I'm sure, because at the end of the day, it's easy to think that he made those decisions, as Ananta made those decisions, but did he really? You know, that's the question we need to ask ourselves.
Do we really do anything?
That is the big life question. You know, we're all just chess pieces being moved by the great hand. So
the doer, not I.
Yeah. Ideally, I would say. I feel like we have the ability to resist the great hand sometimes.
Yes. And, yes.
Yeah, hardly ever makes anything better if we do, but that's happened. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So the next part is Mukunda takes that message, opens it, reads it. And he it starts with, "Let these be my final blessing, my beloved son Mukunda. The hour is here when I must relate a number of phenomenal events following your birth." And then she basically tells him that she went to baptize him. She went to Banaras, Silahiri Mahashaya, baptize him. And then he says, as a spiritual engine, he will carry many souls to God's kingdom, which is a massive a statement, right? It's like, it's basically your son is a prophet. That's what he's saying, right? Your son will have followers and he will help them. He will give them the greatest service a guru can give a disciple, right? Reveal God to them, show them, deliver them to God's kingdom, which is something that if you are the mother and you hear this again, Chris said she didn't fall off her chair. I would have fallen off my chair. But I think this is also goes back to that. I think Lahiri Mahashaya mentioned that before already to the parents, right? That even when she was still pregnant, he was mentioning something similar to her, right? He was mentioning to her that her son will play a great role. And our friend Priyank, he kind of said that for him, this message that Mukunda's mother presented to him in this little note, for him this was a very dramatic, a very moving, one of the most powerful events that happened in the whole book. He says at least top five. So very, very interesting, and it's right at the beginning, right? It's right in chapter two, and you already have something like this happening, and if you read it, it is written very beautifully. And it goes to show also the kind of how like what Chris mentioned earlier, this the spiritual timing of everything. Like you read this, like you couldn't, if it was a movie, you couldn't write it better than that, right? You get this message and then it's all written so beautifully. And it's probably exactly what Guruji wants to hear, because if you remember, he had just tried to escape his home, go to the Himalayas, because he had the vision of the yogis in the Himalayas, and he maybe had the feeling that in his past incarnation he was one of them, and he felt drawn to that. So that was kind of what he wanted. And he had this connection also this way with Lahiri Mahashaya. And Lahiri Mahashaya is a very important personality as well. He's basically the person who, from Mahavatar Babaji, was given the Kriya Yoga technique, and he spread it through the world again. And he will use Yogananda as one of his vehicles. And there's a section from Man's Eternal Quest that we can read on this. Lauren, would you be able to read the first part?
Mm-hmm. About Lahiri Mahashaya?
Yes.
Lahiri Mahashaya was a disciple of Mahavatar Babaji, the deathless master who revived in this age the ancient science of Kriya Yoga. Praised by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and by Pantanjali in the Yoga Sutras, Kriya Yoga is both a transcendent technique of meditation and an art of living that leads to union of the soul with God. Mahavatar Babaji revealed the sacred Kriya to Lahiri Mahashaya, who handed it down to Sri Yukteswar, who taught it to Paramahansa Yogananda.
Are you okay, Chris?
Yes, I'm coughing on water. For anybody who's watching the YouTube videos, you'll see them. trying to sort myself out here. But I'm good. I can continue reading. When in 1920, Paramahansa Yogananda was deemed ready to begin his world mission of disseminating the soul-liberating science of yoga, Mahavatar Babaji told him of the divine responsibility that was to be his. You are the one I have chosen to spread the message of Kriya Yoga in the West. Long ago, I met your guru, Sri Yukteswar, at Kumbh Mela. I told him then I would send you to him for training. Kriya Yoga, the scientific technique of God realization, will ultimately spread in all lands and aid in harmonizing the nations through man's personal transcendental perception of the infinite father. Wow.
Beautiful. And this is the meaning, I think, when Lahiri Mahashaya says your son will be a spiritual engine. Because Guruji also mentions here, this is not a new technique. This is a technique that has been going through the ages, has been known to a lot of the great saints out there of all ages, but it has been lost in the dark ages, and it has been revealed again to Lahiri Mahashaya, and he's spreading it in Benares and in throughout India that way, so people coming to him becoming his disciples. And there's a lot of spiritual lineages that start with Lahiri Mahashaya in India. And then Guruji is now the person who is chosen to bring that same Kriya technique to the West. And that's the meaning of the spiritual engine that he's going to be. Yes, Lauren?
It's really amazing, isn't it, when you actually comprehend it. It's one thing to have your guru who is teaching you these life-altering, soul-liberating lessons, but then it's a whole other level that so many came before him, and they each had to have their own journey. They each had to have that that level of absorption and liberation to be able to do that for themselves and then teach someone else, you know, and here we are talking about it today. I know I speak about this often, but I just find it so fascinating. And it's very ineffable. Just, yeah, so much came before us and so much came before our guru to sit here, you know, and I'm sure that when he received that message that, you know, he had been chosen, that's not something you take lightly, is it? You know, that's something you definitely set a foot to fulfill.
This is, I'm sure any listeners who've watched any of our material know, part of my favorite subject, the yogas. Always got to mention it in once in every episode. And it is this grand mechanism of life, isn't it, throughout the universe and the solar systems and the time that the epochs and the ages that we go through and the ability of man to realize God and comprehend God, and then that diminishes in time. And it's such a, I think it's, for me, one of the more significant things in my life that we're alive at this time to help the transition. Do you know what I mean? Like that really speaks volumes to me, that we are a small part of this momentum and bringing into this age, this new age, the light of God and the light of consciousness. And it's a real honor and blessing to be even aware of this and being able to comprehend this to a degree at this time. But for Yogananda, imagine being in his shoes, you know, hey, you're going to be the one that takes this and runs with it, so you've got this. And obviously for an avatar, you know, it's you know, he can take it in his stride. But I think, I don't know what you guys think on this, but not every, you know, realized individual wants necessarily to be a guru. Not every realized individual necessarily wants to take on that responsibility, because it's lifetimes of commitment to, you know, hundreds or thousands of souls, you know, over time. So Yogananda obviously wants to bring souls back to God, and he's talked about that many times, and here it is manifesting for him. So I'm sure this would have been many, many lifetimes of effort and desire really in his heart to work for God, to be of service. So here it is manifesting. We get to share in that. It's pretty, like I said, it's pretty special.
I think you're absolutely right. It's definitely a seva, a service that you're doing, even after you have already, there's no necessity for you anymore to incarnate on this earth, but you're still coming back because you're helping others to come back. And there is definitely some benefits that you will get on some level, too high for me to understand. But I just thought of that when you mentioned that is actually, you're right. It's not just for one incarnation, right? Like Guruji has left his physical body, but the disciples that he has, they will only keep growing now, right? it doesn't stop here. It will keep going. And I wonder, in an ascending age, how long this will keep growing, probably for a long time.
Here's something that we can't start talking about because we'll talk about it, you know, for the whole the next 2 hours. But you know, for Guruji, for souls who are living in not in this physical gross plane, but time, how does time pass? Time does not pass as it does here. In this slow, mm-hmm. slow pace of life here. So although it's, you know, life is going by 90 years or however long somebody might live here, it might be significantly less, or might, you know, might be experienced in a different way. So yes, I don't profess to know these things. I just think it's completely fascinating to think about it. But Guruji's commitment certainly is an enormous one. It's monumentous. And here it is being shared with us.
Yes, indeed. It would be a very interesting conversation. I would love to. There's so many theories. If you're an avatar, if you are above time, you can just drop in and out different times. And it's definitely time saving because you don't have it. You don't have to wait for anything. Also, remember, I mean, another spoiler, the Saints with two bodies, it can probably appear in many places at the same time. It can be very efficient, I guess, when you are self-realized. But I think you have normal, to be, you have so many disciples. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, normal rules do not apply.
Yeah, if you are a spiritual engine. All right, and then if you go back to that scene, when I hear the scene of Lahiri Mahashaya baptizing Guruji, I often think of the movie Awake, because I feel like they depicted it amazingly well, right? They showed like this little place where Lahiri Mahashaya, we know that he, at this point, he wasn't sleeping much anymore, right? He was basically sitting in the lobby of his house, receiving disciples day and night, meditating with them a lot of the time, right? And so this is kind of what they are depicting. And then have Guruji's family come in with their newborn son, right? This is kind of what I see when I read this.
But funny, just a two cents to throw in here. When you say that, picture that scene, the Lahiri Mahashaya wasn't really sleeping. He was simply being in commune with God. And Guruji was like that in his later days as well, right? And he kind of shifted gears. We're going to talk about this in a lot more detail in many, many more episodes to come. But Guruji went into that mode as well in some ways when he was really getting into the latter stages of his life. And he was simply put in presence of God more and more. In his practice. So it is interesting, maybe if there was similarities. I don't know what Lahiri Mahashaya, how he was previously to that. I know he had a job and he was a family man essentially, and had responsibilities that way. But it's just, yeah, struck me as maybe quite curious and interesting, because Lahiri Mahashaya he wasn't really in the physical plane for a lot longer after that period of Yogananda was born. I forget exactly how many years, but it wasn't too long. So he was obviously doing his work before he left that plane as well.
Absolutely. And we will hear more stories about him in later chapters, because Yogananda interviews his wife, who lived a bit longer than her husband. And she told a lot of interesting stories about him. Cherry, like, let's go into the subject a bit more of Lahiri Mahashaya blessing him, and let's call it spiritual baptism, because we talked a bit about it before we started recording, how baptism is like a term used of in Christianity, but of course it has a similar meaning in Hinduism. Chris, do you want to draft this one?
Yeah, I was thinking about this baptism, you know, it was a word that I was quite used to and is commonly referred to in my upbringing, you know, where everybody was baptized and Christian, you know, being Protestant or Catholic, you know, you're still baptized. And of course that practice is done usually as a baby, a certain period of time after birth. You would be baptized with water, holy water.
In most water, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And you see some funny videos online of kids, you know, babies getting baptized, and there's different degrees and different practices that certain ministers follow. They can dunk their head in water, things like this. That maybe it's a little bit more traumatic for some kids than others. But for me, I think it was just a little splash.
Waterboarding the kid almost. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for kids. But baptism, very, very curious topic. And really, here they talk about spiritual baptism. Now, what is spiritual baptism? Well, Yogananda talks about the differences between physical and spiritual baptism. You mentioned really the origins of the Christian baptism being in Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist. And that experience was, you know, I gave talk about that for some time. It was very, very beautiful with the Holy Ghost essentially descending upon Jesus at that time. And that's where in Brazil, it's everywhere, the dove, the white dove descending. You know, that symbolism is everywhere. And you can buy these carved out doves everywhere. It's very beautiful. Before I go on, Mike, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just want to flex that I went to Israel, to the River Jordan, to the place where Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. And then I was baptized there by a priest. I was like, I'm Ooh. Here already. And there was like a group of European Catholics. I think they were from Poland. And their priest asked me, do you want to get baptized as well? And I'm baptizing everybody here. And I was like, yes, let's do it.
Sign me up.
Yeah, it was super interesting because they had like I think they were catfish or something. They were like tiny little fish, and so you put your feet in the river, and then all those fish come and start nibbling on your feet and tickling.
people pay good money for that alone.
Yeah,
you got two in one service. Yeah,
absolutely.
Nice. Yeah. I'm sure that's pretty special, a pretty special experience. And Yogananda talks about it in a way, really, that it's a spiritual baptism is one given by a guru. And really, as we know, we've talked about it before, but a guru would come essentially when the student's ready, when the student's really praying hard for to know the truth. And Yogananda says here that God sends the devotee a guru to guide him. After you know an intense period of praying, and the divine grace comes to the devotee when he demonstrates his desire for liberation by sincere constancy in sublimation to God. So this is kind of the path, as it were, to being spiritually baptized. But as Guruji describes it, he says that the guru bestows spiritual baptism on the devotee, by which God unlocks the entry way of the spiritual eye through which the devotee follows the voice. And this is what I was kind of alluding to earlier today, was this Holy Ghost vibration my head. I don't know if it's being suppressed a lot, but just shaking the building around me. Being Irish, I'm not used to it yet.
Zoom is trying to filter it out, but your voice became a bit fainter for a while, but now it's back.
Okay, so yeah, I'm shaking him up, Bootsy. So Guruji describes it, you know, as this shepherd of Christ consciousness to the cosmic consciousness of God. So that's really what's happening there. And we have a little bit to read out just to kind of delve into this a little bit further. So maybe Lauren, would you want to take this one?
In India, real gurus know not only how to baptize with water, but also with spirits or the Holy Ghost. But alas, many Hindus in their temples and many Christians in their churches are baptized only with water, temporarily experiencing good physical baptism, but knowing and perceiving nothing of those marvelous soul-renewing experiences of spiritual baptism. Ministers in churches and priests in temples are oftentimes chosen only by virtue of their intellectual study of the scriptures. Sacerdotal authority conferred on them by ceremonies performed by formerly higher spiritual authority.
Do you want to continue there just a little bit? Or would you want
Yes. No, I was just looking up what sacerdotal means, and apparently it means that it's relating to a priest or a priesthood. So yes. I'm Mr. English as a second language.
Did you hold on, Mike? Did you search that? Because you should have been using the dictionary. Should have been using the dictionary. If Priyank was here, he would be telling you to be using your dictionary. save the energy from the Google search.
Yes. That creates. Of my many books, a dictionary is not one of them. So
Priyank's old school. I think Lauren does that.
Yeah.
No, I use the search engine. Yes. I almost burned my thumbs out using it.
sorry, Priyank. Yeah.
Yeah. I will continue reading. But real ministers and priests who are fit to be gurus train first their inner selves in the theological school of intuition and meditation. They must spiritually baptize themselves first, before they can aspire to baptize others at all. They teach their disciples, not for mundane gains, but being impelled by God, they baptize them spiritually. It is admirable to lecture and teach good principles, but without becoming a real guru, one cannot redeem souls, nor should he accept others as disciples until he has progressed far himself. Very good point.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a definition where, yes, there's the water, the tradition is, you know, they have to, the priests give water over the head, usually I think it is, which is always curious to me. Christianity has a lot of Hindu traditions in there that encourages hinting that Hindu temples, they have to use baptisms as well. And I looked online and I couldn't really see a lot of material on baptisms in Hindus, but they have like a naming ceremony where they something very similar to what we consider to be a baptism, where you get to name the baby, I think 11 or 12 days after birth. And they would put some water over the head and have that kind of ceremony there as well. So Guruji here is saying that yes, you can have that ceremony of sorts, but it's more of a physical baptism. But a true spiritual baptism can only be given, or it's only done by ordained gurus. That of course is God directs that. So, but that is more, as I mentioned, quite. This is the thing why I love SRF. They don't think it's such a wealth of information here. It's the unlocking the entryway of the spiritual life through which the devotee follows the voice. Like mine, yes, I can't say blown, Frank doesn't like that word, but mine's just expanding in all directions.
Boggled. I think we agreed on boggled last time.
Boggled, didn't we? Yeah, that's right. But curious to me, but before I go on to say something different, Mike, do you want to jump in on that?
I think Guruji's holding baptisms to a really high standard here, right? He says, mm-hmm. I mean, he does say it's admirable to do it anyways, but it should really be done by a real guru. And mm-hmm. I guess in this age, the people who seek God are many and the people who know God are few. And that's why that's all we have sometimes. And really being in the presence of someone like Lahir Mahashaya baptizing you is an enormous blessing in a time like today.
Not only being in the presence of that happening, but it's actually happening to young Mukunda as a baby. He's getting this, this unlocking of the spiritual eye through which the devotee follows the voice, that confirmation that spiritual baptism as a baby, and that's something really, really special to my mind. I imagine, that maybe happens later on in life and for most of us, and really the initiation that we're talking about baptisms, really, for the highest technique of meditation is Kriya Yoga, as we would follow through the SRF. That is the spiritual baptism of the SRF and for us that is the spiritual baptism according to the research that I did. So that is as if you want to be spiritually baptized, you essentially have to be initiated into Kriya Yoga. And that's something to look forward to for those of us who maybe haven't done that yet. And for those who have, it's an amazing blessing that has been bestowed upon you during those initiations. And I don't think really they're doing them in person as much anymore because of COVID, but maybe that's starting to change now. They're going to be having more in-person initiations now. Is that right, Mike? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so I surf at the windmill every now and then, and recently we had a christening there. So I think this is all back to normal now. I'm not sure if there's maybe there used to be many more, but they're definitely back happening again. Lauren?
Yeah, I know that the monks are planning a visit to the London Center to do some Kriya initiations, which is very exciting for those that are ready. I won't quite be on the right lesson by that point, but it will come in good time. So yeah, when Chris said, you know, it's something to look forward to, it definitely is, and I'm very excited for the day.
Amazing. Yeah, I think Kriya initiations is one of the things that really hasn't really happened much during COVID.
Mm.
And I imagine there is a lot of people who during this time have progressed into that realm and haven't had a ceremony. So there must be quite a backup. Yeah.
Well, I know one of my friends, she had hers at home. So instead of like the actual ceremonies, they did it, you know, like that. But, I think either way is great. Not that I can profess to know anything about this subject because I don't know. But I do remember reading that. I think it's maybe in the autobiography. I can't remember. But I remember us discussing that from Paramahansa Yogananda. He didn't have the ceremony. He did away with all of that and had just the initiation by his guru. So, you know, all paths lead to the ultimate.
Yeah, everyone has their unique path as well, right? So
yeah,
everything happens for a reason, and we are back to divine timing as well. Everything happens at the right time in the right place. Absolutely. We can move to the next part, and so now we're still him reading that message. So we talked about why he got the message late. We talked about in the message there were a few things happening that were, let's call them supernatural. They had to do with the Hari Mahasaya, but then another thing happened. So okay. First we have Chris jumping in. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt quickly. Yeah,
I did the thing that I thought I was going to do before the call, which was forget the thing that I wanted to say about the baptism. A question that I had was curious. Okay, here's one for you guys. So we were told essentially there by Yogananda that the baptisms really are given through the guru. So the guru bestows spiritual baptism, right? So that's what he was saying. That's very, very curious because here's Yogananda getting spiritually baptized by the Hari Mahasaya. But as we know, his direct guru is, that's his Param guru, right? So his personal guru is really intentional. So the question to my mind was, well, okay, if I did, you know, go through the Kriya initiation myself, and that's a blessing that, you know, I can receive through my guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, and accepting him as my guru, that's maybe coming direct from him. So my guru received his blessing by his Param guru. So I suppose when you're that advanced, you know, who knows, it doesn't particularly matter if it's your guru or param guru. But maybe we can be, can we be blessed by the gurus in Self-Realization Fellowship lineage? Is that a, something that we can expect to be the case?
I feel like this would be a really good question for our listeners and viewers to tell us what they feel. It'll be really interesting. I personally feel that as all these masters have united with God, that they are all one. So in a sense, they are outwardly in their forms, they are reflections of the different aspects of the divine spirit, but actually as they have journeyed back to source, they are one consciousness. So even though Yogananda was baptized by Lahiri Mahashai, actually it's still Swami Sri Yukteswar, because they're all with God. That's my feeling anyway. Who knows whether it's truth, but what do you think, Mike?
It also shows how magical Guruji's life was. I mean, the coincidence that his later guru, his guru was actually his param guru, like Chris said, is actually also the person who baptized him himself, right? Kind of makes it a lot easier to show the whole lineage. And then his parents were disciples of his param guru without knowing, right? Like Guruji went out there. I mean, I'm always spoiling, but he goes out there, looks for his guru, and then his guru happens to be on that same lineage. And then later on, his guru and his father would have great respect for each other as both being disciples of Lahiri Mahashaya. I guess there could be, you could think of kind of other examples where this might not be the case, and then you might create some kind of friction or something, but probably wouldn't, as long as the gurus would all be, if they would be self-realized. There's this story that a monk told once that said, like, if instead of all the people in the world who fight wars and everything, if you would take all of their prophets, put them in a room, there would be complete harmony, right? And so I feel in that sense, it kind of might not make that much of a difference. Chris?
Hmm. Yeah, I suppose this just reinforces the question to my mind, which is, why, I've talked about it in a previous episode, that why did our guru need to define them? Why did Yogananda go really searching for a guru when he was baptized by the one and only Lahiri Mahashai, mm-hmm. when he was, you know, coming through having miracles and healing given to him by Lahiri Mahashai? His mother and father were devotees initiated into Kriya Yoga by Lahiri Mahashai. And the only thing I can say about this is, well, one, I don't know, but two, is how beautiful and substantial a relationship he has with Sri Yukteswar. You know, whenever they've met, and we're going to go through that in another episode, it's just this beautiful relationship that is, you know, eons old. You know, it's this ancient relationship going past many lives, and with Lahiri Mahashai as well. But it just speaks volumes to me that he really was, you know, seeking out Sri Yukteswar, and obviously as well that he was there in physical form for him throughout his journey as well. I'm sure had some substantial reasoning behind it as well, but it's curious to me, really, in more than one sense. Lauren?
I feel that perhaps Yogananda felt that he needed a guru because the guru shows you the way, right? He's your teacher, and even though he's been blessed by Lahiri Mahashai, he left his physical form before perhaps Yogananda had the conscious ability to be able to be always in tune with him. So to have a guru to teach him and to initiate him into Kriya and all of this, that's probably potentially why, it would maybe take him longer to reach his final realization if he didn't have his guru there with him as Yukteswar. What do you think, Mike?
There was also that idea that he was looking for a living guru.
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes to show how much Yogananda has left us. Like, Yogananda's legacy is not just his life, but he created an organization. He created ashrams with monks and nuns. He created an extensive portfolio of literature. He created lessons. And he kind of created a structure where you can follow him even though he's not in the flesh anymore. But he left something behind that you can follow and you are meant to follow. So, and then maybe it wasn't the same with Lahiri Mahashaya. Maybe with Lahiri Mahashaya, he did not create this kind of big organization on, I'm guessing on purpose, because he started out small. He was the first person who got Kriya Yoga from Babaji, and he selected some disciples and he passed it on to them, and then it grew organically from there. And then Yogananda was one of the disciples who created a massive organization out of this knowledge. And that is also something we can take for granted, but it's a really something that sets him apart, and something that also, I guess, is meant when Lahiri Mahashaya calls him a spiritual engine, right? He's not just there for the people in his immediate surrounding, but he builds a worldwide organization that is followed by people in countries that he hasn't even visited, right? That's like, but it's still there and still growing. I think we can move on to the vision of the great light.
Sorry.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I did warn people to say at the beginning we probably could talk about that subject for episodes. So let's put it to bed.
It would be very interesting.
Yeah.
We saw that in an earlier episode that Guruji described that he had a vision of yogis in the Himalaya. He was asking the question, what is behind the darkness of closed eyes, right? And then he got an immediate answer. I asked that question myself, but it wasn't the same experience that Guruji had. So Guruji saw a divine light, and he asked the light who he was, and he got an answer. Even he said, I am Ishvara and I am the great light. And what we find out now in the next passage, in that note that his mother left for him, was that it wasn't just him seeing that light. It was his mother and his sister Roma were looking at him. They didn't only see Mukunda in trance, they also saw the light. And that was meant, I guess, to show his mother and his sister that the divine nature of Mukunda, how spiritually advanced he is, and how he is special, I guess. That's the only way you could say it. How, like, you, if you have an avatar as a sibling or as a son, I guess it's good to know that, right? Because it makes it easier when certain things happen. And I'm guessing that happened very early in his life, and they know when she told him. And I guess that kind of reconfirms to himself that this was a really big experience that he had there, because it wasn't just him seeing it. It wasn't like something that it was just for him, but it was also for his parents. There is, unless like it is not 100% clear if it was that experience, but I guess you guys would agree, right? That because that was the experience they were talking about, right? I guess that's why he also mentioned it. The one where he says, I am Ishvara. And yeah, amazing. If I had a son and suddenly I see him in trance and then I see that light myself and hear it speak to me, I find that amazing. And there's one section in the Bhagavad Gita that we can read out, that where Guruji talks about the experience of a yogi, when a yogi kind of makes an experience of the divine and what happens with his body and how it feels like. Chris, would you be okay to read the first part of that?
Mm-hmm. Yep. When in superconsciousness meditation, the heart is calmed and the yogi can stimulate at will the spiritual center of the medulla, or point between the eyebrows. He can control the inner and outer searchlights of perception. When he switches off the lights of the gross senses, all material distractions vanish. Then the ego automatically turns to behold through the reinforced inner searchlights held by the soul, the forgotten beauty of the inner astral kingdom. The heart-quieted yogi in superconsciousness becomes able to see visions and great lights, to hear astral sounds, and to become identified with a vast, dimly lit, lightened space, alive with glimpses of beauties hitherto unknown.
In the external conscious state, man does not see God's active manifestation as the beautiful cosmic energy that is present in every point of space and that constitutes the luminous building blocks of every object. He perceives only the gross dimensional forms of human faces, of flowers, and of other beauties of nature. The soul coaxes man to turn his attention searchlights inward to behold, through its astral vision, the ever-burning, ever-changing, multicolored lights of the fountain of cosmic energy playing through the pores of all atoms.
So when we say Guruji has seen a great light, it wasn't just like somebody's pointing a torch at you. It is really, you see the light behind all creation. You don't see the material forms anymore, but you see the source of everything. So it's a massively impressive experience, I would say. And he was able to share it with his mother and his sister. Yes, Chris?
You know, hearing this story reminds me of the sympathy or the empathy I have with, you know, mankind and the struggle that each and every soul goes through in manifesting as a human, because this is kind of what we're looking for, if not the purpose for us. No, this is what we're all seeking. Like, this is what we're all going after, this union with God, the great creator of all, and experiencing this oneness. And I think in theory, you know, we can play with the idea that, oh yeah, you know, that would be great. Like, yeah, I can imagine that. That would be amazing. But having had the experience, Guruji tells us that you lose all inhibitions to seek material desire in a crude sense. And it's such a blessing, isn't it, that he's actually sharing these moments with us, because they're such personal experiences. You know, we don't necessarily talk about our own experiences on the path, but he's a divine, you know, realized master and avatar, and he's sharing these moments with us. And here he is having these experiences as a young person, as a young man, young boy. So yeah, just such an awesome, like, significant moment that he's sharing with us in the early stage of the book as well. You know, he's really letting the readers know, like, here, these things are possible if you follow the path of yoga.
Yeah, and he, I find it also interesting that he shared the experience with his mother and Roma, because I feel like they are probably very receptive individuals for that. Definitely his mom, we have seen how saintly his mother is. But in the course of the book, we will also see how Roma has very spiritual ambitions for her life. We will see the story of her and her later husband, right? How he refuses to be spiritual, and then this gets reversed, and how she also lives a very spiritual and almost magical life. And there's a story that Priyank hinted to us. It's about the dynamic between, I would say, Mukunda, his mother, and his sister Roma. And I'm just going to paraphrase it a little bit. And it's about, it is a story in Majda, and whoever has read Majda will know that story. I think my dad read that story to me when I was a kid, and I found it very sad. I was very sad because it's Guruji has a pet. It's a goldfish, and he really loves that goldfish. And then at some point, the goldfish dies, and Mukunda is devastated because he's lost that, he feels that pain of loss of that goldfish that he loved so much. And Mukunda is like, he's very sad, and his mother is like, she really wants Mukunda to stop crying about this goldfish, and she is refusing to eat until Mukunda comes out of his state of mourning, kind of, and this way, because of that, Roma asks Mukunda, like, why are you doing this to our mother? And then he's like, I'm not doing anything to her, but she's like, she won't eat until you will get over this. And then he kind of feels like, okay, yeah, I don't want to cause pain to my mother, and wants to go downstairs with Roma to see mother and kind of talk about it. And he hugs Roma with one arm, but in the other arm he doesn't use, and she wants to find out why. And it's because he is holding something in his arm. And I can read this part. It's like the last part of the last paragraph. It says, when Majda still hesitated, Roma saw that he was clutching something tightly in one fist. He quickly hid his hand behind his back. She caught hold of his hand and pried his fist open with her fingers. He was clasping a small pencil and a tiny notebook in which he had written in English, "My red fish is dying." It was Majda's first poem. And when I read that as a kid, I was crying. I was like, oh my God, it's so sweet, it's so cute. And it also shows kind of the dynamic between the three, that it's very loving, mm-hmm. very heart-centered, very caring, especially when Mukunda is a kid, but I'm guessing also later on. Very heartwarming to read those kind of stories, and very it's amazing that this book Meshta exists, where you actually see stories of Guruji as a little kid. Chris?
And as well, just something that I'm mentally noting is like how Guruji was moved by death in his life. It really moved him, didn't it? You know, the instances where he lost somebody close to him or those loved ones close to him. And as a child, you know, you love your pets, don't you? And then it's sad as an adult, but you know, as a child, it's almost everything to you in that moment. And there he is, moved to almost an inconsolable state, and his mother really having to protest in a sense by fasting, you know, by not eating. Maybe she was doubling up with her spiritual practice, and that was a nice way just to take two issues off her hand at the same time. But Yogananda is clearly very sensitive about this gross material plane and the reality of death that comes with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like children especially have a hard time with this. Maybe it's because they come from the astral plane and it's different there. And then when you lose somebody here, it's like it seems so permanent. And this feeling of loss is something that overcomes that. Like I have a little goddaughter, and I know how she lost her pets, and she would also be devastated when they would pass away. And then the last part that we're going through now is the Lauren, do you want to jump in first?
Yeah, I just want to highlight something that we haven't talked about yet. So when she's talking about that great light, and she's telling him that she saw it, she also says in her note, "Your voice rang with iron resolve as you spoke of going to the Himalayas in quest of the divine." And Mike and Chris were talking, I had a quick flick back to the book and in that moment where he's communing with Ishwara. And I feel like when we recounted this in previous episodes, it felt more like a soul conversation between the two. You know, he says, "These thoughts came powerfully into my mind." But it says, when he asks, you know, "What are you?" And the light says, "We are the Himalayan yogis." The next thing he replies is, "Ah, I long to go to the Himalayas and become like you." Which is interesting now reading it, because he was to vocalize that in real life, and his mother and sister were present to hear it. Which is so interesting, because I wonder if he actually knew that he vocalized that in that moment. I don't know, but it's fascinating.
Absolutely. I mean, the way we know Mukunda, he was probably vocalizing it a lot.
True.
And maybe when he was younger, he would have told his parents to take him there, and they might have refused. And then he said, "Okay, then I have to go by myself." Yeah, that could have been the dynamic there. Definitely. I'm guessing if you are a parent, that's not really what you want. You don't want to go to the Himalayas with your kid to look for something. And that's kind of how we have to put it in the context as well. He was like a little kid, right? So they didn't take everything 100% seriously that he said. But then you have a vision of Ishvara suddenly, and then things become very real. So must be very interesting to have an avatar child. Yes.
Yeah. Although saying that, his mother then says, you know, that she knew from that his road, it says here, I came to know that your road lies far from worldly ambitions. So she knows. She knows he's different. She knows that his life is going to be far removed from that of the average human. which it just, again, it just reflects their connection, doesn't it? And her deep spiritual insights.
Absolutely. And that's a good segue to the that last part of the message where, it's like what Lauren just mentioned, that she knew that his ambitions were not worldly. There's a section in the Bhagavad Gita again where Guruji explains our worldly ambitions and their role and how to gradually shed them. Would you be okay, Lauren, to read the first part of that?
When a man tries to find out by meditation what activities he should perform according to the divine plan, he also discovers, to his discomfiture, that he has to work out many other activities of karmic debt engendered by egotistical desires and actions of former incarnations. If, for example, a man has been a material businessman in a former incarnation and later, through disillusionment with worldly life, attains birth in a spiritual environment, he will nevertheless find that recurrent material desires will crop up in his mind unless he has concurrently cultivated a firm desire for God.
He should eliminate the past life material desires by discrimination, saying within himself, in this life, I will perform only the divine duty of knowing God. I will have no other ambition. If his mind still does not find satisfaction, he may engage himself in some material activity, thinking, since I am impelled by a desire of a former incarnation to carry on a business, I will fill the desire this time by working not on the gratification of my egotistical self, but only to please God.
And this is the way for most people, right? Most people, they have desires. They come to Earth and they are pulled here by their desires. And Guruji explains here a way to get rid of them slowly by basically fulfilling them and at the same time fulfilling them in a way that you work for God. However, Guruji, when he came to this earth, he didn't have that. He didn't have those desires. So in order to put him into a, how shall I say, more traditional human life's path, like in order to stop him from basically going off to the Himalayas and meditating in a cave, you would have to find reasons for that, right? Because like, if you are born and you feel like, oh, I want to create a company, I want to have a family, then you naturally, it makes sense for you to go through everything to be good in school, to create a career. But he had no such ambitions. And that explains a lot that happens later on. Yeah, Chris?
By saying that at your next careers conversation, you know, as a child, sitting down in conversations with teachers, like, what do you want to be when you're older? Oh, I have no desires to be anything. You know, I don't desire only to know God. They look at you as if you're crazy, you know, like it just would not be. Just would not be in the conversation. And I'll share something personally, because I think it is kind of funny. Now looking back, it makes a whole lot more sense. But at the time, I remember going through a period of my worlds were crashing together. Essentially, my world was falling apart. I left my job. I'd lost a girlfriend at the time. And I was, you know, as a result, I thought I was going to go back to Ireland. I was living in London, this whole tumultuous time. And there was one word, really, that was soul searching to the nth degree for me, and what led me to the path of SRF. And I remember sitting down with my auntie and said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I might actually return home. I think I might go back to Northern Ireland. She lives in London. And she just said, Chris, you know, surely there's something that you want to do. Surely there's something that you desire to kind of pursue. I remember just sitting there saying to her, literally, there's no desire for me in my heart. There is no desire at all. I don't know what I kept saying. I don't know what I want, because I I didn't know, but it turns out now I do know. It's to be, you know, to commune with God. That is the thing. That is what my heart desires. Nothing else. But I didn't know that at the time. So I was just sitting there going, no, I don't, you know, shrugging. I don't know. I don't know. I didn't have the words. I didn't have the comprehension. And so my auntie, God bless her, you know, she sat there opposite me, just, you know, head in her hands, like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Like, what are we going to do with you? You know, you don't have any desire to, you know, get back into work, do something like. And she thought I was just a mess. And indeed, I probably was. But really, it was the blooming of something beautiful rather than the loss or the inhibition or something like this. But often we, you know, it's so easy then for somebody to view, you know, me, you know, somebody who would be in my position at that time as maybe somebody who lacks ambition, who lacks this drive to go out into the world and quote unquote be someone and have a career and, you know, follow this material path. So I think this world in the Western world is quite hard and kind of clashes with this idea, doesn't quite comprehend the idea to pursue God first. And you can still have these, you know, successes in life with a great career. And the Hiram Ashi taught us that and others. So, you know, these things will come to you if they're spiritually aligned. But it is such a great teaching there to put God first. Then everything else, whatever needs to come, will come. But yeah, thought I'd share that little personal story.
Amazing story, Chris. Thank you for sharing it. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And oftentimes those situations sound difficult, but they also help you to get your priorities. You see what in the world is transitory and what is permanent, right? And you surely want to build your life on something that is permanent, right? On a hard rock rather than on like a soft pile of sand, right? And that's kind of those are teaching moments then, I guess, right? Where you kind of make a decision, and then later you look back to this time and say, this is where I turned things in this direction, and ever since then things went very well. And
yeah.
Yeah, I guess Guruji was already, yeah.
Yeah, it builds faith, yeah. It's going through those experiences, builds faith more than anything.
Yeah, and Guruji, he probably had those experiences in past incarnations, but in this incarnation, he was already, he knew what he wanted, and it was divine. It wasn't something worldly. And it makes complete sense, right? Because he came as an avatar on a divine mission that he wasn't told yet, right? He didn't know what his mission was. So until he knows what he has come here to do, he was like, okay, what I actually want is go into Himalayas and be with those yogis, because that's kind of the, first of all, he remembered it from past incarnations. And second of all, that was kind of the life he most desired to live, really, right? And so it's not really a big surprise. And then when his mother was told about that, she kind of knew. She was told as well that he would become the spiritual engine, but she kind of knew that he wasn't going to become a banker or something like that, right? Or a great businessman with a huge family. So as we saw with Ananta, mothers, they see a great responsibility in family continuity, right? So they would like start looking for brides for their sons, right? And start talking to other families. And I guess she kind of knew early on with Mukunda it wouldn't be like that. Yeah. All right. I think we did justice to this page and a half here. So we talked about Ananta finally handing Mukunda mother's letter, how she had experience with him of the great light, how she had baptized him, and Lahirmasha presaged that he would become a spiritual engine with millions of followers, and that his ambitions would not be worldly. And I guess in the next episode, we will talk more about the last part of this chapter, which is how she was given the amulet, and the amulet itself, the meaning of the amulet. And there is one more point that we have, because we have had quite a lot of questions recently, especially on YouTube. And we want to ask our listeners first of all, we want to encourage them, because we have a lot of questions already. But if you have any questions, I think YouTube or social media is the best way to ask the questions. And then if they would appreciate a section at the end of an episode where we would just go through some of those questions and answer them as a group, please let us know. And I think we have come to the end of this episode, and we want to thank you all for listening. And I want to thank Lauren and Chris for joining us. Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.